Thank you, Tony. Well, it's been a pleasure to spend the sabbatical year here at the ITP and interact with Tony and learn a lot of biophysics. Actually, despite the title, I will not be talking or emphasizing too much things related to vacuum, but fluctuation-induced forces in general. No, I won't. Okay, this was the updated title, so let's go to this one. Okay, so this work was done mostly in collaboration with Ramin Golestanian, who was actually a postdoc at ITP until a couple of years ago and is now a professor in Iran. It started back about 8 years ago with another graduate student, Hao Li, who's currently at UCSF, and currently two postdocs, Torsten Emig and Andreas Henke, has been working on related problems. So I'll start by giving you a brief introduction to the theory of the Casimir effect and some of the more recent experiments that have rejuvenated interest in this area, and actually spend a lot of time talking about the analogs of these phenomena, where rather than dealing with quantum effects and quantum fluctuation, one is dealing with thermal effects and thermal fluctuation in statistical mechanics. And in particular, there is a very nice realization of the Casimir effect in superfluid films and their wetting that I will discuss in some detail. There's a close relationship between Casimir forces and van der Waals and other dispersion forces. But it's also good to emphasize, in addition to their similarity, their distinction, and in particular, how shape-dependent the Casimir forces are. And as an example of trying to search for these shape dependencies in experiments, I'll talk about some effects that may or may not have recently been observed in rough surfaces. And to talk about rough surfaces, I need to introduce a path integral formalism for you, which very naturally then leads to dynamical versions of the Casimir effect. And that's where the title of the talk about the friction of vacuum comes from. So, in 1999, Casimir was awarded the prize of the one of the prizes of the American Physical Society. This one is for his excellence in industrial research as a leader of industrial research at Philips Research Labs, where he worked for 30 years. And actually, some of the most famous works that we are familiar with, including the Casimir effect, date to that period. So just to remind you what the Casimir effect is, what he noted was that if you take two metal plates in vacuum at some separation H, then the electromagnetic field that lives between them will need to be have wave vectors k such that the wave vector in the direction normal to the layers has to be quantized by the restriction that the, say, electric field or the magnetic field has to vanish on the two boundaries. Once you go to the realm of quantum mechanics, each one of these normal modes you replace with a harmonic oscillator, and then the energy of a collection of those harmonic oscillators, even at zero temperature, you have the ground state energy. So each one of the modes has an h bar omega of that particular k, which is simply the velocity of light times the magnitude of that wave vector, times 1/2, which is the zero point energy. And of course, if you add all of these things, you will get an answer that is infinity. And one of the things that Casimir showed was that buried in that infinity, there is in fact a part that is finite and depends on the separations H. And that part has this very simple form. So it depends on some combination of fundamental constants, h bar c, some universal amplitude, it is proportional to the area of these plates, and the separation between them as h cubed. And if you take a derivative of that, you will find an attractive force between these two plates. So shortly after the prediction, there were a number of attempts in trying to experimentally look for this force. The first set were by Abrikosov and also separately by Sparney. And these early experiments, these experiments are very difficult to do because you have to worry about dust particles, about electrostatic charges, all kinds of things. So they were not very definitive. All you could say is that they were consistent with the presence of some kind of an attractive force. There was a rejuvenation of interest in this area a few years ago when some high-precision measurements started to appear. And again, interestingly, in 1999, another prize of the American Physical Society went to Stephen Lamoureux for one of the things is observation of the vacuum Casimir effect. So what he did was he used the torsion pendulum to measure the force between a sphere and a gold plate. And at that time, he claimed that there was agreement at the 5% level. But maybe that's too optimistic. But there is certainly very good agreement with the trends of the Casimir effect. And another possibly more definitive experimental test was performed just a couple of years later by Mohyeddin and Roy, and there they use sort of tricks from atomic force microscopy to measure the force between a sphere and a plate, and the position of the plate can be moved by putting voltage on this piezoelectric crystal, and the position of the sphere, which is attracted to the plate, can be looked at by the deflection of light bouncing off a cantilever. And so by doing these kinds of things, they could measure the dependence of the Casimir force as a function of the separation. The range of distances we are talking about is 0.1 to 1 micrometer, and the forces are for the sizes that they were looking at of the order of 10 to the minus 12 Newton, and there is a reasonably good agreement in this figure, which has now actually been improved, so they have much better fits between theory and experiment in the recent work of Mohyeddin and Roy. Okay. So
were the absolute values also in agreement?
Yes. So these forces are absolute values, and you can say how they converted the distance to a force, and they do that by calibrating this apparatus by putting electrostatic charges, and they think that they know the absolute value of the force pretty good.
And calculated with the Lipschitz formula?
The Casimir force. The Lipschitz formula or the Casimir formula, they're more or less the same, but one has to incorporate effects that are finite temperature effects, roughness effects, and the finite conductivity. And all of those things were included, and they shift this curve up and down typically of the order of 5 to 10%.
The Lipschitz formula in some cases can differ quantitatively very substantially.
Yes. So it's basically this finite conductivity effect, yes. But it doesn't, in this case, change by more than 5 to 10%. So they do that.
Not everyone is as learned as Walter.
Yes.
So Lipschitz formula is the kicking mechanical geometry?
No. You see, the Casimir force, I assume that the electric field vanishes at the two boundaries, which is true if you have an ideal metal. Now, a real metal, if you go to very high frequencies, the electromagnetic field can go through it. So you have to have corrections due to that effect. And so those corrections are taken into account in Lipschitz formulas and variations of that, where you think about a full, if you like, dielectric constant of the media that you are dealing with. I can't say offhand, but I would guess basically the size of these clouds of points that you are looking at. For this particular version of the experiment. So this figure is taken actually from this paper dating from 1998. The more recent papers that I've seen, the agreements are much more tight. So the errors come from a number of sources. One of them is you have to have a good idea of what the separation is, and you have to have a good idea of what the force is, and they all kind of accumulate. Now, I'm a statistical mechanician, so I'm more interested in aspects of this that occur at finite temperature. And roughly 30 years after Casimir, there was this very nice paper by Fisher and Degen, who talk about a variation of this Casimir interaction that you have for ordinary materials due to thermal fluctuations. But ordinary materials, but basically thinking about thermal rather than quantum fluctuations. So imagine that between your plates that previously we had vacuum, you now put some kind of a fluid. Now, the presence of the boundaries changes again the structure of modes and the free energy of the fluid. And you may ask, well, how does that change depend on the separation between the two? Now, in most cases, the influence of one boundary decays into medium only of a distance of the order of its the correlation length of fluctuations. So these two would not know about each other, the two plates, if the separation is larger than some typical correlation length. But when you look at the phase diagram of a system of liquid and gas, we know that there is a critical point. At that critical point, the correlation lengths become infinite. And what Degen and Fisher said was that, well, at that critical point, the correlation length has gone to infinity. The two plates now should know about each other. And there will be a change in the free energy that depends on the separation. Free energy has units of kT, so we should put a kT here. It should be extensive, so we put a factor of area there. And to make up for the two dimensions of length, we have to divide by h squared. And so this is basically the formula that they proposed up to some numerical constant, which these dimensional arguments don't tell you. Also, I guess I implicitly assume that there is an attraction. And so this general form has been verified and extended recently, and in particular, Cardian has indicated that, say, in two dimension, this number is a universal quantity related to the typical, related to the universality class of the phase transition that you are looking at. Yes?
Attractiveness is just an assumption?
Attractiveness comes out as a result of calculations. I guess the point is I cannot justify why it should be attractive or repulsive. Now, it sounds almost clear that it should be attractive so that you would do this to get rid of the disturbance. But I guess equally you could do this to get rid of the disturbance. And in fact, if you look at the interaction between two hemispherical shells, it is repulsive rather than attractive. So it is very geometry dependent. Well, yet another version of where you could see this effect due to thermal fluctuations is if you look at something where you have correlations, again, that extend over large distances, and another way of getting long-distance correlations other than being at a critical point is to be in a phase where you have Goldstone modes, and a good example of that is provided in the case of superfluidity. So this is the phase diagram for helium, where in addition to the gas fluid line ending at the critical point, which has infinite correlation, once you cool the fluid, at some point it changes character and becomes superfluid. And inside the superfluid, you have broken some continuous symmetry, and there is a phase that can fluctuate freely, some kind of a phonon, if you like. And again, if you bound that phase between two plates and ask how does that change the free energy of the system, you'll find that there are changes in the free energy that depend on the separation of the plates, again, dimensionally proportional to kT A over h squared, and some number that one can calculate, and indeed, in this case, demonstrate that it is an attraction. So this is all interesting, but can it be seen in experiments? A very nice experiment to see these effects in helium were proposed and carried out recently by Garcia and Chan at Penn State University. So the idea is the following. Imagine that you have a bath of helium, on top of which at some separation, you suspend some plates. Now, helium has the character that it likes basically everything better than itself. So it goes and tries to coat these plates, gaining some advantage from the van der Waals attractions that it has with the atoms of these plates. And this is called a phenomenon of wetting. And so the question is, what determines the thickness of this wetting layer? So let's take a look at that. To take the helium from the liquid and transport them further off, you have to do work against the gravity. Essentially, there's a chemical potential difference. And so the energy to create an object of thickness V. Yes, this is the origin of the problem. Has a part that is proportional to this thickness times the chemical potential difference. So there's that part. And I said that the reason that you go there is because you have the attraction, the van der Waals attraction to the substrate. If you add the van der Waals part, you'll find that the attraction falls off as 1 over d squared. Now, in addition, I'm proposing that there may or may not be a Casimir force, so let's include that potentially. And if you extremize this as a function of D, you'll find that the thickness of the wetting layer is obtained by a combination like this. So basically, the van der Waals part wants to thicken, and the difference in chemical potential wants to make the film thinner. Now, point is that if you look at that expression and keep this phase diagram in mind, if you were to lower temperature, you will go from this phase out here at high temperature, which is an ordinary fluid, through this superfluid transition, which itself is a critical point, down here inside the superfluid where you have these Goldstone modes. So this term that I had indicated here as the coefficient of the Casimir interaction will be zero in the high temperature phase, some critical quantity at the transition, and a contribution from the Goldstone modes in the low temperature phase. And so what they did is they monitored the thickness of these films as a function of temperature. And so what you see is that there is some value in the high temperature part. Once you get to the critical point, there is an additional force, it comes down. Once you go to the low temperature phase, this critical Casimir part vanishes, but it doesn't go back all the way to zero. There is an additional remnant, which is due to this Goldstone type of fluctuations. Now, in the picture of the experiment that I showed you, we can see that they had a number of these substrates at different separations from where the liquid was sitting. So essentially, they were carrying out a number of these experiments simultaneously at different values of the chemical potential, and they were getting different curves for each one of them. why they don't quite match up and collapse into one is something that I'll come back and discuss. Now, before going into that, I wanted to read from a general reference frame article that Dan Kleppner, my colleague, wrote about Casimir interaction. And the nice paragraph that he has, the van der Waals interaction is generally described in terms of a correlation between the instantaneous dipoles of two atoms or molecules. However, one can just as easily portray it as a result of a change in vacuum energy due to an alteration in the mode structure of the system, and the two descriptions are equivalent. So what is he talking about? So in the previous setup, we had the vacuum disturbed by two flat plates. We might as well consider putting those plates into the form of two spheres. And again, the structure of the modes of the electromagnetic field will be different in the presence of the new boundary conditions that we have to impose by the presence of these two spheres. And if you ask what is the corresponding change as a function of the separation between them of the ground state energies, you'll find that, again, depending on whether you think about thermal effects or quantum fluctuations, you will get two different results. The thermal result is always simpler to figure out dimensionally, because this has the dimensions of kT. You have disturbed the space over the product of the two volumes, so it's kind of a good guess that it should be the product of the two volumes divided by r to the 6 to make it dimensionless. When you go to the quantum regime, the source of fluctuations becomes rather than kT h bar, which has an additional dimension of length, so you have to divide by r to the 7th. Now, what's the relationship of this to the standard van der Waals interaction? Well, if you have two atoms, the standard picture is that basically the fluctuations in one of them will induce a dipole which has correlations with the dipole that it induces in the other one. And if you look at the effect of the two of them, you'll find an interaction that goes like the product of the polarizabilities divided by r to the 6th and some characteristic excitation energy of the atom. Now, this is called the non-retarded van der Waals interaction. And what Casimir and Polder showed, following against trying to explain some results of experiments, that if you look at these things at the atoms at larger separations, that form will cross over into another form, which is actually identical to what I had before. So you have a crossover from r to the 6th to the so-called retarded van der Waals, or r to the 7th, and this is what was calculated by Casimir and Polder, and basically what they can show is that this form is actually quite universal in the sense that it doesn't really depend on any parameter of the atom under question. Now, is there some kind of a thermal version of this? And Pincus and Gulyan and Buinsma pointed out a nice potential example, which is if you have a membrane, typically you'll see, say, red blood cells are flickering all the time because their bending is such that because of thermal fluctuations, they're constantly vibrating. And if you look at realistic membranes, they also have lots of proteins and other things sitting on them. And so a nice question that was posed by Gulyan, Bruinsma, and Pincus was how does the modification of the fluctuations by the presence of proteins, let's say model as two rigid objects embedded in this fluctuating surface, cause an interaction between them? So for, say, the energy of the fluctuating membrane, you could basically have the bending energy that you would have before with some parameter that is the usually called the rigidity. And you can embed these two objects and ask how does the potential change in the fluctuations depend on the separation between the two. Again, dimensional arguments. The potential has to be function of kT. In the case of the van der Waals, we had the product of the two volumes, so here it will likely be the product of the two areas, A1 and A2, or A squared if they are the same, and then it has to dimensionally fall off with separation like R to the fourth. And again, you do some work to find out this coefficient of 6 over pi squared. That's not easy to do, but anyway, that's some kind of an attraction. And you can see that because you are modifying fluctuations in a two-dimensional space, the nature of the interaction has fallen, is now falling off as 1 over r to the fourth rather than 1 over r to the sixth.
Yeah, and since you made a point of underlying the ITP postdoc, Boolean as well.
Boolean was also an ITP postdoc, and actually the next thing that I'll show you was something that I did with Boolean when I was on sabbatical last time around at the ITP, following up on this work. One thing that I would like to sort of, a theme that I'd like to emphasize a little bit for the next few transparencies is the differences that one has between Casimir-type interactions and van der Waals type of interactions. So we saw there were some similarities. But the Casimir interactions are really a function of geometry and shape. And this is sort of nicely illustrated by this example that we worked out, where rather than putting two circles, let's say, on the membrane, we put two rods. And for the rods, now you can have an additional variable, which is the relative angle that you have between these. And you can ask, how does the interaction change as a function of the separation as well as the angles? And so this is the answer that you get. But the point that I would like to emphasize about this is that if you had thought that this type of interaction is very similar to van der Waals, maybe what you would have said is, let's break up this rod into lots and lots of elements, each one of them maybe you want to think of as an atom, and add up all kinds of pairs of interactions between these two rods. If you do that, you'll find a totally different angular dependence. So this is one example where this shape dependence is illustrated. And as I try to give in an answer to David Gross's questions earlier, the most dramatic example, of course, is when I said if you have two hemispherical shells, rather than attracting each other, they would repel each other, something that you would never have with adding attractive interactions. So unfortunately, the hemispherical example and this example of the rods are hard to do. So maybe we can ask the question about the two examples that I already gave you where Casimir interactions have somewhat been measured, whether one can go and look for some signature of this shape dependence being different from van der Waals and additivity in the earlier experiments. So the earlier experiments that I mentioned, one of them was this measurement of the thickness of the wetting layer of helium, and the other was the Casimir force between this sphere and the plate. For the Casimir force, more or less following some other suggestions that we had made, Roy and Mohyeddin went and looked at the case where rather than having a flat plate, they looked at a sinusoidally modulated plate. And I'll discuss the effects of that change in shape of the plate. And the other thing I mentioned already was that in the case of the helium wetting experiment, you had results for different chemical potentials, and in principle you should have been able to collapse all of them together, but you couldn't. And one potential reason that is mentioned by the experimentalist is the roughness of the surface. So let me talk about these two cases in a little bit more detail. So let's first think about this thickness of the helium wetting layer. So imagine that you had a flat substrate and you formed a film of thickness H. Previously we were calling it D, but it's the same thing. I said that there was a chemical potential difference that was made up by, first of all, an attractive van der Waals potential, actually one can do slightly better than the van der Waals form that I had given you before by including so-called retardation effects, which are reasonably well known for these surfaces. So this part is pretty well known for wetting of films. In addition to that, there was this part that was due to the Casimir interaction, which was a function of temperature and change depending on whether you were above the critical temperature or below. And this is a standard dimensionless measure of how far away you are from the critical point. Now, if you try to collapse data just using that form, this is what you will get. They don't go together if you change the heights and hence the chemical potentials. They can be fitted together if you scale them appropriately, and what they say is that one way of doing that is to imagine that actually this is an effect due to the roughness of the substrate. So your substrate, rather than being a flat plate, is something that is kind of fluctuating. And because of that, they added a fluctuation correction term whose origin is something like this. The type of term that we are interested is 1 over h cubed, but let's say that we don't know exactly where h is because of this roughness. It is fluctuating around some average by an amount that we call small h. If we just expand this and average, the first correction that we get is some kind of a term like this that depends on the fluctuations, RMS roughness that you would have. And that's basically what they used. And they found that they could achieve good collapse of the data because in some sense they had enhanced, if you like, the Casimir part of the interaction with a thickness that is reasonable in view of what you know about the roughness of these substrates. Yes. Because the first order term actually vanishes, the second order term comes with a plus sign. Okay? And so it is important because this is indeed an enhancement, if you like. But so they did this and it works fine, but it's really a cheat because they did this replacement only for this term. Why not do it for this term also? Okay? And because empirically they found that if they did it for both terms, the two effects would somehow compensate each other and they wouldn't get a nice collapse. So essentially, however, you could turn this argument around and say what they have really shown by these things not collapsing is that the Casimir part has a dependence on separation when you are dealing with a rough surface, which is different from the standard pairwise additivity that you have for van der Waals. So let me tell you where this could potentially come from by going to the other example that I was mentioning. Roy and Mohyeddin looked at the interaction between a sphere and, rather than a flat plate, a plate that was corrugated, so that the amplitude of these deformations was a very known function with an amplitude of around 60 nanometers, a wavelength of 1.1 micron, and they were scanning this separation H over that range over there. And they were indeed looking for deviations from standard additivity. Now, we did the calculation of what the Casimir force should be in this case. And what you find is that, well, it is a function of the separation as well as the two parameters that describe the modulation, the amplitude and the wavelength. And you can look at two limits of it. In the limit where the wavelength is large, so you have basically long wavelength modulations, what you find is that if you look at the correct result, it reproduces what I had in the previous case, like you were basically expanding something like 1 over h minus plus a cubed, you get the same correction that you had before. But in the other limit, where the wavelength is very small, so you have lots of small scale roughness or fluctuations, the expansion is very different, and rather than falling off as 1 over h squared, in fact, it falls off as 1 over h. So it's really a much more enhanced addition because of the roughness when you have short scale type of fluctuations. Now, can this be observed in the experiments? Actually, if you go and look at the parameters that they use in the experiments, you find that the range that they are looking at, their A over lambda is around 0.05, and they're basically scanning the range in heights, which is down here on the dashed curve. So basically, they are looking at a range which is not really that different in terms of what you would get on the basis of, say, pairwise additivity. So one of the things that we've suggested and they are going to try to do is to make smaller scale fluctuations, maybe go into this regime where the non-trivial shape dependencies become much more pronounced. Could you repeat the question, I think? Oh, no. I just did it because I could illustrate the result of the calculation in the simplest way. In fact, our result... Yes, because what we have here in this regime is an expansion in powers of these fluctuations. And at this order, we could add up the contributions from different wavelengths. So if you had, in fact, given me a surface whose roughness was characterized by a set of different wavelengths, lambda and A, then I would obtain the overall result by basically superposing those things. Okay, so I told you these results say about rough surfaces, but how did we obtain them? In the standard Casimir interaction, you basically quantize and you add up all of the modes and you have some regularization scheme, etc. But when you are dealing with a rough surface, how can you find the eigenstates and the corresponding energy? So clearly we didn't do it that way. So how did we do it? So this is just two transparencies of calculations and then we go again to simple stuff, but it's important to know how we did it. Basically, let's say for the case of the superfluid, we have some field that is fluctuating between the two plates. And let's give it this very simple action, which is basically the strain squared with some kind of amplitude that gives the cost, energy cost of doing that. And so what we want to do is to calculate a restricted partition function. So we want to integrate over all possible fluctuation of this thing divided by kT. But with the restriction that I have specified the two boundaries. So basically, I want to restrict my fields inside this domain. And let's say I require the fields to vanish at these two boundaries, just as an example of a boundary condition that one would like to impose. And one way to impose the boundary condition that, let's say, the field vanishes at this point is by introducing the delta function that the field vanishes through some integration over some auxiliary field of e to the I psi times the value of the field. So basically, this is just to impose the boundary conditions at the two surfaces. Now, since this is a Gaussian theory, with my assumption, one could integrate over the field phi and express the result as an integration, as an interaction between these auxiliary fields living on the two surfaces. And then this answer, in turn, being a Gaussian integral, is the determinant of this kernel. And what we developed, and this was really the hard part of the calculation, is a way to evaluate the log of this partition function, which is the free energy, in a perturbative series in the two deformations, H1 and H2 of the two boundaries. And so what you find to zeroth order, if you have no deformations, the standard Casimir result for thermal case, and then the correction that you get depends on the two fluctuating fields, H1 and H2, and some appropriate kernels that connect these two. So this is the generalization of the result that I had given you before, which applied to the case where basically each one of them was assumed to fluctuate independently. In reality, you need to take care of this whole kernel. Now, this is how you would do it for the case of the superfluid. How would you do it for the case of the real Casimir effect where you have to quantize a field? Well, actually, the procedure is more or less exactly the same. To do the appropriate quantization, rather than integrate in three dimensions, I integrate over four dimensions, the fourth dimension being some kind of a time. I've changed my phi to an A, to sort of anticipate that I would ultimately have to put some kind of a gauge potential over there. And I have to do a very similar integration with similar boundary conditions. And then the same kind of mathematics that we applied previously will allow me to get the log of this, which I will call some kind of an effective action, as a power series. The first order term would be giving me the standard Casimir effect, and then I will have various corrections. Okay, so from this we could get the results that I had quoted you before for these modulated surfaces and their generalizations. Now I'd like you to sort of sit back for 10 seconds and think about this, because buried in this is actually an interesting result, in that I could do this, first of all, just replacing gradient squared integrated in three dimensions with gradient squared integrated in four dimensions, because electromagnetism is a relativistic theory in which up to factors of C, the space and time directions are treated equivalently. And nothing in my formalism says that I should constrain my fluctuations of the surface only to deformations in space. So basically, just by the same mathematics that we were using before for, say, describing superfluids, extended to the case of a four-dimensional space-time to quantize the electromagnetic field, we are able to deal with boundaries that can change in both space and time. Okay? So suddenly we can go beyond the standard picture of two flat metallic plates to plates that can deform and change their shape also as a function of time. So let's see what one can get from that. And that's basically entering the realm of what is called the dynamic Casimir effect. So as opposed to the static Casimir effect, for which there are lots and lots of papers, there are only many, many papers on the dynamic Casimir effect. And as far as I could see, the first set of these papers goes back to Moore, who in 1970 considered basically a 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time. And the reason he did that was because he could use some conformal field theory method to sort of map the case of the moving two-point boundaries to the case of the flat one. And based on that, he could calculate something like the dependence of the force on the distance between these two points that made up the boundaries of the 1 plus 1 dimensional space. Goes like the third derivative of the displacement. Later on, building on that, Fulling and Davis talked about how in this kind of geometry there was potential for the creation of photons and radiation emerging from the two boundaries. Some other types of methods, the conformal field theory does not generalize to 3 plus 1 dimensions, so there were some kinds of generalizations of fluctuation dissipation theorems applied to think about the force that you would have between two plates in three dimensions, and the third derivative goes over to the fifth derivatives, and there were some other versions of it thinking about dielectrics, etc., that a number of people have worked on. And let me tell you some of our results, or results that one can obtain from our formalism, applied to this geometry that we already saw before, where we have one flat plate, one flat metallic plate, and the other one that is corrugated with some wavelength lambda, corrugated only in one dimension. And let's imagine that we take the corrugated plate and we move it as a function of time. So the distortion in space-time is given by some function of x minus however you want to move this. For example, you could oscillate it with some frequency omega. Let's keep the other one, for simplicity, stationary. So as I told you, what we have is a way to calculate, given a specified boundary in space-time, what the effective action S is perturbatively to the second order in his deformations. So we have that to second order. We could take a derivative of that with respect to the displacements, and that you could interpret as a force. So since we have this to second order, we basically will have a linear relation. And so what we have calculated is, if you like, a linear mechanical response of the vacuum between these objects to a particular deformation in space and time, if you like. There could be a residual force also. So the next few transparencies, I basically will tell you some of the results that we can get by looking at the properties of this response function. First of all, imagine that you start to vibrate this corrugated plate, and you look at the result that you have for small frequencies, omega. If you calculate everything and then make an expansion valid for small frequencies, since more or less everything is analytical, you won't be surprised that the first term in the expansion that you would get would be proportional to omega squared. Now, a relationship between force and displacement that is like omega squared is what we have in Newton's law. Mass times acceleration is force. So you could regard the coefficient of this omega squared as an enhancement to the mass of the plate, because as you are trying to move it, you are dragging the electromagnetic vacuum with you. Now, because of the weight...
Is that equation related to the wavelength of the corrugation?
Yes. So this K would be 2 pi over lambda. Yes. So, but you are two equations ahead of me. Okay. So if we look at this plate that is corrugated, there's two ways. There's no reason that I should just vibrate it in the direction of the modulation. I could also vibrate it perpendicular to that. And what I find is that if this is the direction of the modulation, I do it along the modulation, there is no change in mass. But when I do it so that I do it orthogonal, if you like, or parallel to the modulation, depending on your perspective, there is a change in mass. So you have an interesting effect that, I mean, maybe for condensed matter people should not be too surprising, because the mass of an electron inside a solid depends on the direction that you try to move. It's a tensor. But to think of the mass of a plate that is sitting in vacuum as being more than a scalar is interesting. So indeed, you get enhancements to the mass of this corrugated plate that depends on the shape of this object. Now, is it something that you are likely to measure if we sort of substitute some parameters? Actually, the mass enhancement is very small, so I'm not really holding up too much hope for that, but it is an interesting theoretical effect in any case. Now, what happens if you start to vibrate this faster? What you find is that if you go beyond a certain frequency, then suddenly your response function becomes imaginary. And typically, response functions that are imaginary, you can think of, say, something like viscosity times the velocity being equal to force. And so interpret the coefficient of that imaginary part as some kind of a viscosity. So what we have is that if we try to vibrate this plate very fast, again, it appears that there is some kind of a dissipation that suddenly sets in. And again, it depends on the shape of the object. So if you have the corrugations this way and you try to slush it back and forth that way, there is no dissipation. But if you do it in the orthogonal direction, it becomes unhappy and you start to feel some kind of a resistance, if you like, friction, although it's not your standard friction form because it has lots of frequencies appearing here. So it's highly frequency dependent. In fact, if you multiply it with that omega, you get omega to the fifth, which was this d by dt to the fifth power that we had seen coming on earlier. Now, if you think about the structure with the two plates, the structure of this response function becomes even more complicated. once you hit frequencies beyond the resonance frequencies of this cavity that you have formed between these two plates, and in that limit there are divergences in your response function. We are doing calculations for infinite size systems, so essentially we interpret that you cannot move an infinite size object in that regime, but presumably for finite size object, what that could mean is that you start pumping lots of energy into the modes of the cavity that you have generated here. But there's an interesting consistency check or question that one can make. That is, if you are trying to vibrate this object and you feel some kind of friction or dissipation, where does the energy go? Well, the only thing that we have available to us in this theory is electromagnetism, and so the only way that it could go is in the form of photons. So can we figure out where the photons are and where they can be radiated? And this is actually Golestanian afterwards did this with the student Miri, and he could relate the spectrum of emitted photons to some two-point correlation function of the field that one could also calculate perturbatively, and eventually we could calculate for the case, very simple case of just a single plate that is undulating or vibrating, what the photons were leaving as a function of angle and frequency. You could get that spectrum. But again, what I was saying, this interesting consistency check is if you integrate over the energies of all of these photons going all over the space, you basically find that the amount of energy that is radiated per unit time is equal to the amount of energy that we were losing to dissipation. So it seems like we have accounted for what we lose and where it goes, and we don't have to worry about all kinds of things. Although, again, this is done for this very simple geometry. Okay. So let me summarize. So I started by talking about the standard result of, textbook result of the Casimir interactions between two metallic plates. And then we said, well, that's due to quantum fluctuations. Can we find some analog of that where the source of fluctuations rather than quantum mechanical is thermal? And we found a number of examples, including being at a critical point or actually more generally having some kind of a broken symmetry phase where the Goldstone modes of the continuous symmetry could provide you with infinite correlations. I talked about the example of wetting in superfluids. Actually, Dan Hohn was asking me earlier about liquid crystals. There is indeed some work that basically one could look at analog of these things in liquid crystals that also have some kind of broken continuous symmetry. Although, again, I don't know of a clean experimental realization for that. We have some potential experimental realization. Then there's also corresponding things where rather than thinking about flat geometry, you think about spheres and inclusions in membranes. And again, basically any time you have some kind of a medium where you have long-range fluctuations taking place, infinite correlation length, you put two things in it, you cause disturbances, you have long-range interactions between them. And again, the nice thing about these long-range interactions is up to prefactors, you can get most of their behavior just by dimensional arguments. And then we basically saw that an important aspect of that was that there was also, in addition to these similarities, important distinctions between van der Waals forces and these kinds of Casimir interactions that are very shape dependent. And looking at rough surfaces and deformed surfaces could be a good way of thinking about those shape dependencies. And the path integral method that we developed for thinking about and calculating things with rough surfaces naturally led us to this unusual world of the dynamical Casimir effect. where we found that the mass of an object depends on its shape, there is dissipation in vacuum, and you have uncharged bodies that are radiating, and these are all things that you don't have with classical analogs. But again, maybe from the perspective of the condensed matter physicist, you can think of them as the vacuum being just another complex medium, and if you try to move something through it, it reacts back on you. So finally, let me go back and read again from this reference frame article that I showed you before of Dan Kleppner. The final paragraph of it is nice. So what have we learned? First, that one must take the vacuum seriously. Second, that intermolecular forces and a number of slightly bizarre radiative phenomena, possibly even creation, have something in common. And third, that Casimir is pretty smart. Now, this was written in 1997. Unfortunately, Casimir passed away last year, so we should change that is to was, but certainly we can continue with his inspiration. Thank you very much.
Questions? David?
I don't have a question, I just had a comment. Do you know about, have you ever I just bring it up because it's related to the Casimir connection and what you were saying here, strange geometry dependent.
Right.
So Dirac wanted to have a model of the electron that was non-singular. They spread the charge out of the spherical shell. Of course, that spherical, no point, no
right.
Infinite of energy, but there's a e squared over r squared, r is the radius.
Right.
Tends to expand this
right.
Electron. But he said, well, there's the Casimir effect. Two right. parallel plates attract, make a spherical shell, there will be a Casimir effect that attracts, which will give a force h bar c over r squared.
Right.
And those two will balance if e squared over h bar c is some number which we could calculate.
Right.
The hope was you'd get 1/37.
Right.
And I think that was done in the late 40s. And it wasn't until the late 60s that a student of Shelley Baschel
right.
actually did the calculation for a sphere. Maybe you get 1/137. Right. Turned out to be repulsive.
Right. I had heard that story, but I hadn't associated Dirac as the originator of that idea. I think Casimir also had this idea.
I know the student, and he had a lot of trouble getting a job.
You got the wrong answer.
Question on the sign.
Yes.
I think you can make sort of baby mechanical models for this. For example, if you have a beam made of solid, some solid
yes.
between two walls,
yes.
which you know now Lucas can make
right.
small versions of.
Right.
So now the question is, how will the funnel modes of this beam depend on its elongation?
Yes.
And actually, you can answer this without any calculation because there is something called the Gruneisen constant of the material.
Yes.
Which is how the funnel frequency depend on volume.
Right.
And actually, in most materials, when you make the volume larger, the funnel frequencies go down.
Yes.
Which will give you a repulsive interaction.
Right.
And only in substances like the negative thermal expansion, mm-hmm. the normal attractive sign.
Right.
I think it's another example where
you have the opposite.
The sign is really, you know, can be debated. Now, the question is, then there is a question. You have a piece of dielectric,
right.
which is vibrating in vacuum.
Yes.
So is the physics that you are changing the boundary conditions on the electromagnetic field in the vacuum? And because of that, you induce some maybe higher order polarization in this field? And this, or maybe higher order moment, and this is what radiates out.
Could be. If you think about the standard sort of Lifshitz approach where you're thinking about some kind of a dielectric material and how it goes over to the case of the infinite conductivity and just the boundary condition, I guess is that in the limit of infinite conductivity, you don't see the atoms that are inside the material, it's only the ones on the surface. Whether there is some generalization of that one could work out for the case of vibrating ones, I don't know. The calculations that we did was just perfect conductors, and it would be interesting to repeat the Lifshitz type of calculation for the case of motion.
Walker?
I have a question about the geometry. The geometry that we discussed with two objects, I think we showed them spheres, on a membrane.
Yes.
And exerting a force on each other due to the fluctuation.
Right.
There are, without fluctuations, there
yes.
are, of course, elastic.
Exactly. Yes.
Now, how do they compare?
Actually, Phil should give you that answer. I think in the paper, when they calculated, in most cases, they found that the leading interactions that are not fluctuation parts are dominant. So that was why I didn't really spend too much time on that class of examples, because also in the case of liquid crystal, once you put boundary conditions, you have elastic strains, and you calculate the energy cost of those elastic strains, and these are sort of so-called matrix effects, two bodies on a matrix that attract each other. They dominate the fluctuation part. In the case of liquid crystal, some people have come up with some interesting boundaries that would eliminate the elastic energy, and then maybe it is possible to look at the fluctuation part.
Questions? Yes?
Okay. Now, I have a question. At the beginning of the talk, you emphasized the fact, again, related to the geometry question, that the Casimir effect, you don't get it by just adding up simple two-body van der Waals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's also some recent work by, I think maybe Ken Kim, where he points out that even if you look at some of these problems, like the inclusion problems in membranes,
right.
that again, if you use the Casimir thing as the interaction we computed, if you have more than two of these objects, again, they're not two-body additive.
Exactly.
And so,
yes.
So, where are we going with that? I mean, does that mean that I should never think of these things as I have to do a whole many-body calculation.
Yes, that's true. I think actually what you find in the case of the number of inclusions on a membrane, certainly you can then separate out the two-body, three-body, higher-order interactions by the ratio of the size of the object and their separation. So in principle, you could, in some limit, just think about two-body forces, but when they come close to each other, it's a full many-body calculation. Yeah.
So far, only people with a certain age have asked questions. So, questions from younger people and students are especially welcome.
Middle age.
I see. The young people understand very well. Okay, well, let's thank the speaker again.